How do you pronounce it?
My name is Paul Graywall, Your Honor. I represent the appellants in this action.
Right. That may sounds better. The way I pronounce it made it sound like cereal.
May it please the court. Although the parties have addressed many specific issues in their briefs, this appeal is really about one overarching question, and that is whether state law may eliminate the specific protections for reverse engineering that Congress crafted when it enacted Section 1201F of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I'd like to focus my remarks today on two particular points. The first, the irreconcilable conflict between plaintiffs below broad license restrictions on all copying and reverse engineering and the express protections provided in Section 1201F. And second, the protections afforded to the appellants by Section 1201F against Blizzard's claims under Section 1201A for circumvention and trafficking.
Could I ask you a question before you get into that issue? I'm a little puzzled about what's left in the real world here after the consent decree, which is pretty far-reaching. So I understand all these legal issues, but what kind of relief is there left? What are we arguing about?
What we're arguing about, Your Honor.
Is it just a, you know, theoretical exercise we're going through?
What we're arguing about, Your Honor, is the distribution of the BNetD server. In the consent decree, there was relief provided to the plaintiffs with respect to the development of the product, that is, the work that's actually done on the product and its evolution over time. What's at issue in this case is the distribution and my client's ability to distribute that product throughout the marketplace. I'd like to start with the precise nature of the conflict that is at issue in this case. It's important to understand that when Congress enacted Section 1201F, it did so against a backdrop of extensive case law affirming the right to reverse engineer. Now, in 1992, the Ninth Circuit, for the first time at the federal appellate level, affirmed reverse engineering as a form of fair use and held that it was entitled to protection as against claims for infringement under Section 106 of the Copyright Act. Now, the Ninth Circuit was the first court, but other appellate courts followed, including the Eleventh Circuit as well as the Federal Circuit. For its part, the Supreme Court has also explained why reverse engineering must be respected under the copyright law. It's noted that reverse engineering is an essential part of innovation, and it leads to significant advances in technology benefiting the public's interest. Now, again, it was against this backdrop in 1998 that Congress amended the Copyright Act to add new claims for liability under Section 1201A, and those are claims for trafficking and circumvention. At the same time as Congress granted these new rights to copyright holders under Section 1201A, it specifically crafted an exemption from liability under Section 1201F for a particular type of reverse engineering that it believed was essential to promoting competition and innovation in the computer and software industries. In fact, Your Honor, as we explained in our brief, if you look at the legislative history behind Section 1201F, it's clear that Its purpose in enacting the section was to foster competition and innovation in that computer and software industries. And so while Congress did not enact a broad fair use exemption to the claims under Section 1201F for circumvention and trafficking, it did include an exemption for a particular form of fair use, that is the reverse engineering that's laid out and identified in Section 1201F. Now, those are Congress's purposes. Congress's purposes were to protect reverse engineering even as it expanded and extended new claims under Section 1201A. The contracts at issue in this case, the so-called shrink wrap and license agreements, stand as an obstacle to those purposes. And they do that because they specifically ban all copying and particularly all reverse engineering without any respect for the specific rights to reverse engineer granted in Section 1201F.
So what you're saying is federal law gives individuals the right to do what was done by the defendants in this case, but that the agreement between the defendants and the plaintiffs in this case prohibit them from doing it.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Federal law under 1201F crafts a narrow exception for a particular type of reverse engineering, and as Your Honor's question or point suggests, we believe we meet the requirements under Section 1201F to qualify for that safe harbor. It doesn't provide a broad exemption for all forms of reverse engineering in all cases. And the conflict here is between that federal grant under Section 1201F and the state law that's enforcing the contracts that were entered into between the parties in this case.
This case comes down to whether federal law preempts the state law that's used here, or whether there's some invalidity in the contract itself. Is that pretty much what it boils down to?
On appeal, Your Honor, what it boils down to is whether or not federal law preempts under the doctrine of conflict preemption the state law that's at issue. There were challenges to the enforceability of the contract below before Judge Shaw. Those are not before this court today.
So we're limited to looking at the preemption issue.
And specifically the conflict preemption, Your Honor. Because as we explain in our briefs, as the Supreme Court has explained and as this court has itself recognized, there are, in fact, three separate forms of preemption. There is express preemption, which in this case refers to the express preemption provision in Section 301 of the Copyright Act. There is field preemption, and there is conflict preemption. Now, the parties agree about field preemption. That's not at issue here. And where there is a disagreement is whether there is, in fact, a live express preemption issue, either before the district court or here on appeal. And we expressly disavowed any challenge on express preemption grounds before the district court. But nevertheless, the court conducted a express preemption analysis, exactly the same type of analysis that was conducted in other appellate courts, such as the Bowers case from the Federal Circuit or this court's decision in National Car Rental. Now, those cases provide for a test, an extra element test, it's called, for express preemption challenges. But that test doesn't apply, whereas here, the parties don't raise an express preemption challenge. And in the Supreme Court's decision in Freightliner, and in numerous precedents that we cite from this court, it is clear that when considering preemption, one must look to the specific conflict preemption doctrine when that's the challenge that's being raised. Now, I mentioned that the contracts at issue here ban all reverse engineering, and that stands in marked contrast to what other contracts in this particular industry provide. Blizzard's contracts make no exception for reverse engineering for purposes recognized by law. As we point out it, in section, at page 317 and 320 of our record, there are licenses in this very industry that make that proper accommodation. Now, this case, Your Honor, is not materially different from the case and the circumstances considered by the Fifth Circuit in the Vault decision, which rejected these types of restrictions based on their impermissible conflict with another form of fair use that Congress spoke to clearly and specifically. In that case, fair use for the purpose of making backup copies of copyrightable material or archive copies under Section 117 of the Copyright Act. Now, the district court dismissed the Vault decision from the Fifth Circuit in part because, in the district court's view, parties may waive their statutory rights under law in a contract. But the Supreme Court has spoken to that, and in the Brooklyn Savings Bank case, which again we cite to in our brief, Supreme Court has said that where a private right is granted in the public interest to effectuate a legislative policy, waiver will not be allowed. And that's precisely what we have here. It's important to understand that the 1201F exception does not serve merely a private interest in building interoperable computer software. As this legislative history makes clear, the public has enjoys a significant benefit and an essential benefit from that open and competitive market in those types of products. Now, the reverse engineering rights here under Section 1201F are precisely the same types of rights that the Supreme Court was speaking about in the Brooklyn Savings Bank case. They were, again, granted in the public's interest to promote uses of copyrighted material that not only benefit the defendants in this particular circumstance, but really the public by creating an open and thriving market for interoperable software. Now, it's useful, I believe, to understand the full context of reverse engineering, to look back not only at the cases that held that reverse engineering were a form of fair use, for example, the Sega case, which Congress cited to explicitly in the legislative history, but to go even further back to the Supreme Court's precedent, for example, in the Bonino Boats case, which we cite to in our brief, and in cases even earlier than that, such as Kewaunee Oil, where the key issue in both of those cases for the Supreme Court was the public's access to matter not protectable under federal law. And in the Bonino Boats case, the Supreme Court looked at its earlier decision in Kewaunee Oil And notice and observe that in Kewaunee Oil, where the court was considering Ohio's Trade Secret Act, there was a specific provision in that act, in that state law, allowing for reverse engineering. And that, in contrast, under the Florida statute in Bonito Boats, there was no such exemption. And so the question again was, to what extent the public's interest in accessing that information that Congress has determined must be in the public realm is thwarted. Now, Judge Shaw also spoke to the concern about private parties being able to waive these rights in the form of contracts, and the specific issue of whether parties can contract around this particular limitation. Well, again, I would direct the court's attention and invite the court to carefully review the Supreme Court's precedent, also in the Brulat case and the Scott Paper case, which dealt with, in the patent context, a party's ability to waive its right to avoid payments long after a patent had expired. And the reason why the Supreme Court in both of those cases held that even private contracts can't waive rights is essential in the particular circumstances we're talking about. The court in that case, in Scott Paper, said that if a manufacturer user could restrict himself by express contract from using the invention of expired patent in that case, he would deprive himself and the consuming public of the advantage to be derived from his free uses of the disclosures. And so what the Supreme Court has recognized is exactly what Congress recognized, in that case, is exactly what Congress recognized in Section 1201F, was that certain individuals, limited sets of individuals, really serve as agents for the public at large, really serve as representatives of the public interest at large. And so when they are attempting to waive their rights, they really aren't authorized to do so.
Well, what is the public interest that you're serving?
Public interest, Your Honor, is the public interest Congress identified when it passed Section 1201. That's an open and a competitive market for interoperable computer software that works together with one another. Because what Congress recognized was that software that works together with one another creates added value for the public, not just for the people who write the software.
So in your case, they've got their game, and is what you offer basically the same thing without the ads and easier access?
What we offer, Your Honor, is something much more. We offer the ability to play Blizzard's games over the Internet without having to use Battle.net. One effect of that is that our people who use our server would not be exposed to Blizzard's ads. That's correct. But, of course, we also provide additional functionality far beyond just simply allowing the two players to connect. We allow people to create these accounts, to join in tournaments, to communicate and chat with one another. There's a whole range of functionality provided in our product that goes far beyond just connecting to one another over the Internet.
Would you address the Bowers case from the Federal Circuit that seems to stand contrary to what you're arguing?
Yes, sir. Bowers is a Section 301 preemption case. It is a case that looked at whether the express preemption clause in Section 301 of the Copyright Act preempted contracts that restricted reverse engineering. That case did not address a challenge on conflict preemption principles. And that is the difference between what we're arguing here and what happened not only in Bowers but frankly also in the National Car Rental case, where the challenge was brought under a separate and independent form of the preemption doctrine that really really reflects the essential nature of the supremacy clause, which is, of course, where the preemption doctrine comes from. So Bowers was a Section 301 case. This is a conflict preemption challenge case. That's the principal difference.
But your case is in new territory and establishing a precedent that would like us to make here.
Our case, Your Honor, is no different than the Fifth Circuit case in Vault. In that case as well, there were restrictions on reverse engineering that were used to preclude a party from exercising its rights granted under a specific provision of the Copyright Act. And the only difference between Vault and this case is that in this case we are talking about preemption, of course, under Section 1201F. And so in that respect, Your Honor, we are asking this court to clarify that, like Section 117 in Vault, Section 1201F provides specific rights to a particular form of fair use.
Does anybody know how many pirated versions people are playing with?
We don't know, Your Honor. before the district court and through discovery, there were expert reports submitted estimating and guessing and speculating as to the extent of piracy. We have in our joint stipulated facts agreed that Blizzard has generated certain dollar amounts of revenue. We have also agreed that and the record is undisputed that there is piracy occurring. But in terms of quantifying, that was never established.
I mean, there are a lot of interests here. I mean, there are all the ingenious people that you're representing here that are thinking about new ways to do things. On the other hand, the copyright law is one of the foundations is the idea that it's going to spur creation, in this case of a game, and so on. So it's hard to cut the thing apart in each case.
I think the thing to do, Your Honor, is in each individual case to look to the specific provision in the Copyright Act that the party is relying upon. In Vault, it was Section 117. Here, we're relying upon Section 1201F. And the impermissible conflict between our provision, as in Vault, preempts state law from enforcing their absolute restrictions on that particular activity. See, my time is up, Your Honor. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Roback.
Good morning. I think the problem with what I've heard so far this morning is that the argument acts as if the DMCA were not enacted. We went to 30,000 feet and talked about some rights, but we didn't look at what Congress did. The Sega case that was talked about was a case involving reverse engineering. Let's talk for 1 minute about how reverse engineering showed up here. Reverse engineering has been around in the law for centuries, never in copyright. Nobody reverse engineered a play. Nobody reverse engineered a painting. Only in the last few years, when we were talking about this complexity, did we get into reverse engineering. And we did it because, as Sega said, what they wanted to do was be able to get past, to drill past protected expression, to get down to things that were not protected and to go ahead and use them and build on them. The problem was in the late 90s, this meant that there could be rampant piracy. It was obvious. Everybody knew it. In fact, no game, no program can hit the market where it is not put on the web immediately. And as a result of that, to get the creativity that we want under the Copyright Act, the DMCA was passed. Now, the DMCA is Congress's resolution of this issue. What you did not hear anywhere in the argument a few moments ago were the requirements of 1201F. Let's start with what's been admitted here and then go on. I know the court knows the facts. These people are sophisticated computer engineers who bought games which had on their package a warning that inside was an end user license agreement and that there would be terms of agreement. They loaded them on the computers, but they couldn't load them yet. Something goes in front of them and says, here is an agreement. Do you agree? It's not the old shrink wrap where you ripped it off. It's click wrap. You have to affirmatively say that I agree. It tells you what you can do, and if you don't want to do it, you can take it back. Remember, we're not talking about pacemakers now. We're talking about a game. Somebody wants to take this back. They walk right back to Best Buy or wherever and go 6 inches to the left or the right and buy another game. By the way, there is nowhere in the record where it is said that this end-user license agreement or the terms of use are any different or broader than others. That's not in the record. But in any event, what did they do? They went past that after they agreed, and they did a few things. Despite the prohibitions, they decided to replicate all of the user visible aspects of the program. That's the expression that the copyright laws are made to protect. And that they did it in a way that would so as to appear to the player to be identical by circumventing a protective measure. And what you haven't heard and what hasn't been appealed from is, in violation of the end-user license agreement of their contract, redirecting protocols, hosting internet play. They did reverse engineer, but not just as all the case and its progeny talk about. Remember I said a moment ago, drilling down past the protected expression? Instead of doing that, when they got there, they took 50 or so icons, 50 or so symbols that are clearly protected expression, and they built them into their server. And I don't know anywhere where there's a fair use de minimis, I only stole a little exception. And then after that, they posted it on the internet, knowing full well that this would involve the use of pirated games because they did it themselves. Now, the court below found the breach of the contracts, portion of which has been appealed, some of which has not, and enough has not been appealed, for instance, the hosting internet games, that this would stand in any event. Breaching the anti-circumvention portions of the DMCA and the anti-trafficking. Now, the contracts, in fact, are enforceable. They claim they're not enforceable, and they also claim the DMCA was not violated. I'd like to spend my time on both of those two things. First, you have to look at 1201F. The argument that was just made was made to Congress, and the result was you can reverse engineer if you do so after having lawfully obtained the right to use a program, and the sole purpose of the reverse engineering must be for the identification of elements necessary to achieve interoperability of an independently created game, and that act must not involve copyright infringement. Now, the first thing they said in their brief to you was that even the court below found they had lawfully obtained the right to use a program. Judge Shaw did not say that. At page 1185 of his opinion, as reported, what he said was that by agreeing to the end-user license agreement and the terms of use, they had a right to use the program, but signing Universal and Corley, a case which somehow wasn't mentioned to you today, citing that case said that's not the same as a right to reverse engineer or to go into the protected portions of the program or to circumvent. In fact, they never had a right to use the game for creating environments to play against each other, to hosting online, enabling internet play, or redirecting the protocols. None of those things were mentioned. Note that the concept of licensing some but not all of the right of the use is ancient. You can go to the bookstore now and buy someone's play, The Crucible, and you can read it. That doesn't mean you can produce it. The idea of licensing certain use but not all is ancient and untouched. The sole purpose here clearly was not the identification, as Judge Shaw said, of elements necessary to achieve interoperability. If being interoperable meant you met the anti-circumvention provision, there would be no statute. All interoperability programs, by definition, circumvention programs, by definition, interoperate. They must. That makes no sense. So what this statute says is circumvention necessary to achieve interoperability of an independently created program. Their brief says independently meant we did it without the other guys. Well, whoever invents a program that's going to interoperate is probably not the same guy who invented the first program. It can't be different people, meaning independent. Independent means transformative. And even the cases they cite, such as Connectix, talk about transformative, meaning not merely superseding the object of the original creation, but creating something original. So you were told a few minutes ago. But all this is transformative. It does different things. But you were also, if you've seen the documents, the stipulation is that this was to be identical to the user. That's the expressive work. How do you square the two? Well, the fact of the matter is their program did not do anything different. It did change ads from theirs, from ours to theirs. There's a chat room. We had a chat room. What they've done is simply changed control. Who's at the helm? Who's got the con on this program? The fact that they may have used different code doesn't matter any more than there's a million different ways I can copy a painting and still have copied it. In this case, independently created must mean creation of some new, something that goes beyond what was there before. That's what the copyright laws want us to create. That's what the point of the laws are. And how do we know it's not independent? Well, the first one is they've incorporated lots of our different code. Now, I'll tell you it's a small percentage. That doesn't matter. And why else doesn't it matter? The last prong of 1201F is you can't be engaged in violation of a copyright law when – you do this. Now, there's no copyright claim here in this case. That's gone. But just like in a reckless driving case, you can show someone was speeding without charging the speeding independently. It's the fact here that counts. The last prong of a 1201 defense is no copyright infringement. And while there's no judicial finding of copyright infringement, there is an admission that copyrighted icons and symbols and code that belongs only on the server. Remember, we're not talking about the disk that they claim to have bought. They didn't. They licensed it. But that's not there. It's on the server. And they incorporated that into their program, so the last prong isn't met. Finally, the claim that the use of their images was, Finally, what has not been mentioned is Congress looked long and hard as to whether or not fair use would be a defense to the DMCA, and it's not. There's a wonderfully scholarly case, the Ramirez case, which Judge Kaplan wrote from New York, and it's been affirmed by the Second Circuit in Corley, explaining at length how this came to be and why it came to be. And I'm not going to repeat that now. But what does that tell you? It tells you that the rubric of fair use, which is what Sega and so forth were involved with, did not make it into the DMCA. Instead, they wrote 1201F with the prongs that we talked about. And these parties here, in this case, don't satisfy that. I'd like now to turn to the issue of the enforceability, if I might, of the end-user license agreement. As I mentioned before, reverse engineering is a concept that When the Congress looked at whether or not it would pass the DMCA, it was well aware of contract law and contract limitations on copyrights. And what they did at that point, despite recognizing it, was not touch that. Now, how do we know that? Well, as I told you before, reverse engineering is a concept that didn't have any meaning in copyright until Sega and so forth. But when you look at that, several things leap out. Any case that involves the permission for reverse engineering, Sega and the progeny, have certain things that we all see as common. The first thing is the identification and analysis is kept to a minimum to the extent that it's copying. The identification and analysis is never a justification for incorporation of copyright-protected expression into an unauthorized work, as happened here. And the identification and analysis comes under the rubric of fair use. Finally, the identification and analysis is a defense to a copyright claim. Not a right, not an independent right, but a defense to a copyright claim. There's no copyright claim before you. The Sega case, other than surviving in 1201F, is not before you, nor is its progeny before you, the DMCA is. Therefore, when you are hearing an argument that reverse engineering trumps a contract, you're hearing an argument that ought to have been made and was made, perhaps, that was made, in fact, to Congress, and which Congress rejected. This is why the case that was mentioned from the bench a moment ago, Bowers, comes out like it does. Bowers is specifically aware, by the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, 2003, Bowers is very well aware of the issue of contracts, the issue of click, wrap, assent, the issue of the DMCA, and Sega. Now, you were told that Bowers missed the boat somehow because it didn't talk about conflict preemption. With all due respect, is it really possible that a court in this milieu, looking at these issues, and a court which cited the Vault case, if you look at the Bowers opinion, it talks about Vault, but it rejects it. Now, the fact that you don't, that a court did not accept the holding in Vault does not tell you that it missed the point and never thought about it. It tells you it came out differently than counsel would like it to have come out. By the way, our citation to Takino, which was the Fifth Circuit's following the element, the necessary extra element test to avoid preemption, comes directly out of Bowers. The Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit looked at Tocchino, looked at its reference to the decision below, incorporated and approved it to the degree that they didn't repeat it. They simply attached it as an appendix. There's no miscitation there. Finally, the plaintiffs neatly ignore the fact that reverse engineering is just not the only way these terms of use in these contracts were violated. Hosting or providing matchmaking services for the game and environments to allow users to play against each other is a violation of this contract. Using a utility program to enable network play over the game over the internet is a violation of this contract. Since 1998, and I think applicable here, redirecting the communications protocols in English meaning, when you go into the program and trick it to going to this server instead of that server, you've violated the terms of the agreement. And why should we enforce that? Because copyright holders have a right to say what part of a work they'll license. They licensed an individual to do a great deal on individual play with this game, and they restricted the online play. Why did they do that? They did that because rampant copying has made it very, very obvious that you're not simply going to be able to put out these games for a price and sell them. There has to and recover your investment. You have to have some reason to for people to want to buy an original game. And the way you do that in this case is by saying, I'll license you the game on your own, knowing in the back of your mind that it can be gotten by piracy. But the thing that makes these games wildly popular is online play. And so what they said was, but online play will be protected behind an encryption wall with a CD key and a secret handshake, just like the DMCA said we could. And that's what we did. So the end user license agreement was crafted to take advantage of and to act under the DMCA, which permitted us to be able to spend this kind of resources to invent new games, knowing that they'd be pirated, but in some way we would still be able to recover by people wanting authentic games so they could play online, advertising, and so forth. This case does not involve new creation. There may be a case that does. This isn't it. This case, as Judge Shaw found, involves tinkering and piracy. The DMCA and our contract work to keep creation at its height, and that's what's at the heart of the copyright laws, continued creation. The arguments made to you lost in Congress, lost in front of the Second Circuit, in a case that's not mentioned here, but is very, very important, lost in the Seventh Circuit several times. It's a wonderful opinion that we've cited to you by Judge Easterbrook in the Seventh Circuit, talking about why click-wrap licenses, in fact, it was click-wrap, I think, in that one, are good things economically and stir creation. Why being able to split markets is a good thing for copyright. Finally, I would point out that many judges have looked at this issue. I think this quote from the chief judge of the District Court of Massachusetts is appropriate. Has this happened to you? You plunk down a pretty penny for the latest and greatest software, speed back to your computer, tear open the box, shove the CD-ROM into the computer, click on install, and after scrolling past the license agreement, which would take at least 15 minutes reading, find yourself staring at the following dialogue box. I agree. You click on the box, you probably do not agree in your heart of hearts, but you click anyway, not about to let some pesky legalese delay the moment for which you've been waiting. Is that click-wrap license agreement enforceable? Yes. And then the court went on in the ILAND decision, which we've cited to you, 2002, since the DMCA. It's critical, since the DMCA, to approve them. I've got only a few minutes left, and I know the court may have questions. I would only point one other thing about SEGA and its progeny, and that is that since that time, within the Ninth District, although at the district level, there's been Game Masters, there's been Real Network, other cases which have recognized the points that I've made now.
Is there anything in the hearings that led to the DMCA that were similar kinds of activity?
I'm sure there were. I will say this in all candor. I can't come to you now loaded with all that went on. When you said the hearings, you mean the congressional hearings. All of this was here. Most of the people who are either amici here or, in fact, are of groups that are amici were before Congress testifying. There were groups of professors. There was analysis. Again, I would really recommend the Ramirez opinion. It's quite lengthy and it's quite detailed going into these issues and who was where and why and how it came out the way it did. Well, I think for the first time in my life, I finished before that red light goes on.
Yeah, as soon as you sit down, you'll think of something you should have said.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Graywall, how much time does he have left?
Thank you, Your Honor. You heard Mr. Ovak's remarks, extensive discussion about enforceability. You heard an extensive discussion about piracy. And again, the record here is undisputed. This court does not have an enforceability issue under state law before it. We are not here challenging on appeal the issue of the enforceability under state law of either the shrink wrap or click wrap licenses. What we are challenging is whether states may enforce those licenses without running afoul of the conflict preemption doctrine. You also heard a lot, as I mentioned, about piracy. And again, there are allegations of piracy. There are references to rampant third-party piracy, but our clients, my client, purchased or received as gifts each of the games that are at issue in this case. And the only issue is whether the agreements may rely upon that came with those games may rely upon state law without running afoul of the protections that were specifically crafted in 1201F. Now, you also heard much about the specific requirements for Section 1201F. And I'm very eager to talk about those as well. The fact of the matter is that we, as Section 1201F requires, my clients did act with the sole purpose of achieving interoperability. And the fact that they were aware of the use of their game server for unauthorized acts by third parties is of no consequence. I urge this court and invite this court to look at the specific language in Section 1201F, where Congress specifically speaks to the defendant's sole purpose, not the purposes of others, but rather these individuals' purposes in reverse engineering the plaintiff's software. Now, here the record is undisputed. We had no choice but to reverse engineer, and Judge Shaw found that. We had no choice because Blizzard would not disclose to us the mechanism that would allow us to interoperate with their software. And so faced with that, left with no other option but to reverse engineer, my clients engaged in the limited type of reverse engineering that's covered under Section 1201F. There's no dispute.
Other than their games, what other software was this designed to interoperate with?
This was designed to interoperate with Blizzard's game titles, Your Honor, and those game titles alone.
Anything else?
No, sir. No, sir. And there's no dispute in the record that we lawfully obtained a copy of the game. Counsel refers to the fact that the district court found that we did not have the authority to circumvent, and that because we lacked the specific authority to circumvent, we did not qualify under that particular prong of Section 1201F. Well, of course, authority, Your Honor, is a requirement under the prima facie case in 1201A. In other words, in order for one to rely upon Section 1201F, there is a presumption that one has already acted without authority. That language in Section 1201F is talking about whether you stole a copy of the game or whether you bought it. And again, here the record's undisputed. Either as a gift or from purchase, we lawfully obtained a copy of the games. Now, you heard about the allegations of copyright infringement as well, and Judge Shaw referred to these allegations of copyright infringement. The fact of the matter is, Judge Shaw dismissed all of the plaintiffs' copyright infringement claims with prejudice. With prejudice. He dismissed all of their claims. And the fact of the matter is, the allegations about certain limited code that being included in our product did not establish that, in fact, we were liable for copyright infringement under Section 106. Judge Shaw did not undertake any type of copyright infringement analysis. There was no consideration in the record, for example, of our defenses to copyright infringement, for example, the fair use defense that we asserted, our de minimis use defense. And so both because it's inconsistent with his own dismissal with prejudice and with our inability to assert our own defenses, that finding was incorrect. See, my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Well, thank you very much. We'll have a lot to chew on this case. It's submitted, and we will be